to another week of Diffusion. We've got a huge half hour of science for you this week, moving from space probes to hepatitis. Now, I hope you've got your morning coffee ready so you can join the team here. I'm your host, Jackie Pepper, and as we always do, let's kick off with the weekly science news from Chris Stewart.
An answer to the thorny ethical questions of embryonic stem cell research may be provided by mouse balls. Stem cells, a form of all-purpose cell capable of differentiating into many different types of tissue in the body, have been heralded as a possible solution to ailments ranging from brain damage and cancer to Alzheimer's disease. But one of the promising methods of obtaining stem cells is by removing them from embryos, which destroys the embryo in the process, hence the ethical problems surrounding this research. But German researchers have reported in Nature this week that they've identified cells in the testes of mice that have many of the characteristics of embryonic stem cells. If these cells can be used for therapeutic purposes, then they would be ethically sound. The mouse ball stem cells have been shown to be capable of producing heart cells, brain cells, and skin cells in the lab. Many questions remain unanswered about this research, including whether these cells deteriorate over time like sperm cells do. The researchers also acknowledge that, since only men have got testes, this method of producing stem cells is limited to that half of the species. They remain hopeful, however, that a similar source of tailor-made cells will be found for females. Whale song is one of the most beautiful and mysterious sounds to be heard at sea. Now researchers at MIT in the United States have evidence that whales aren't just singing, they're communicating in a language complete with the rules of grammar. The team of scientists used a mathematical algorithm to analyze the songs of humpback whales, which last anywhere between 6 minutes and half an hour in length. Their analysis looks for structure in these sounds, similar to the kind of hierarchical structure in human languages, such as the organization of ideas into sentences, which are made of clauses, which are in turn made up of words. The algorithm analyzes the whale song, looking for repeated sounds and patterns, and compares this to the chance of finding these patterns randomly distributed in a song. The results show that whale songs do indeed have a syntax, which implies that the whales are communicating some kind of meaning beyond just humming along. The scientists stress, however, that they're still a long way from knowing what the whales are crooning about. We know that in some time in the very distant past, the earliest forms of life somehow appeared on our planet. It's natural to assume that the form and composition of the Earth was somehow responsible for this miracle of life. But new research suggests that life might have repaid the favour by helping to create the Earth's crust and the very continents we now know and love. One long-standing geological puzzle is the one about why the Earth's crust appeared when it did. Just under 5 billion years ago, as far as we can tell, the Earth formed. But the continents that wander across the surface of the planet seem to have been created more than half a billion years later, and no one really knows how or why. A team of geologists from Denmark have published a theory that early photosynthesizing life forms may have kick-started a change to the Earth's chemistry that produced the right kind of granite rocks to form the crust. Granite forms when heavier basalt rock melts and then solidifies again. The lighter granite rises to the top, forming a crust and, eventually, the various continents that we call home. The Danish team believe that they have nailed down the source of energy for this process, photosynthesizing microbes, which take the sun's energy and convert it to chemical energy. The rise of photosynthetic life would have changed the planet's chemistry enough to push along the processes of breaking down basalt and forming granite. Without a granite-rich crust to stand on, it's unlikely life forms as cool and groovy as ourselves would ever have arisen on the Earth. So if this theory is shown to hold any water, we can all give thanks to our long-lost ancestors, the earliest photosynthesizing microbes. Thanks, guys.
As well as trying to send a man to Mars and building expensive space stations, NASA, as you might already know, also has a range of science missions to find out more about the universe. The most famous of these is the Hubble Space Telescope, but there are many others, including the WMAP. Since the probe says nothing about global warming, NASA are free to talk about the results and have recently released some key data. Matt Francis reports on what this probe has found.
In recent weeks, NASA has released 3 years of worth of data from the WMAP probe, which is a satellite with a telescope attached to it, orbiting the Earth. Now, this probe is actually one of NASA's most important science missions over the last few years. The reason it is so important is because this little probe can tell us amazing things such as how the universe began, what the universe was like in its very early times, how the universe has evolved since then, and also, crucially, it can tell us what the universe might do into the future. So how can a little probe orbiting on a little satellite around the Earth tell us all this amazing stuff about the entire universe? Well, the key lies in what the WMAP probe is actually looking at, and what it's examining is the cosmic microwave background. Now, this is a radiation that we see wherever we look in the universe, and it's very, very uniform. It was discovered in the 1960s by actually not by astronomers, but by engineers. They were trying to make just a satellite system just to talk to other places on Earth with radio waves. However, they found a strange hum in the system, and they couldn't seem to get rid of it. Didn't seem to be coming from their circuit, couldn't work out where this interference was coming from. And it turned out, when they talked to some astronomer friends of theirs, that this was actually a hum that astronomers had been looking for quite a while. And it turns out this hum is a relic of the Big Bang, which is the most popular theory amongst astronomers and cosmologists at the moment about how the universe began. The Big Bang theory says that very early on in the universe, it was extremely dense, extremely small, extremely dense. And for some reason, at some point in time, the universe went through a very rapid phase of expansion, which we call inflation, and since then has been expanding. So wherever we look today, we see everything around us, all the galaxies that are distant from ourselves, they seem to be moving away. The universe seems to be expanding. And the expansion, if we trace it backwards, comes down to a time where the entire universe was crunched down to a very, very, very small object. And at some point started expanding, and this is known as the Big Bang. So how have we come up with this strange theory, and what does the cosmic microwave background have to do with it? Well, the very odd thing about the cosmic microwave background is it looks the same wherever you look. So if you look at one part of the sky in one direction, it looks very similar to the very opposite side of the sky. In fact, the similarity is smaller than one part in 1,000. Now, this is not what we find if we look at other frequencies of light. For instance, if you just use your eyes and look at the night sky, if you look at one part, you may see a star. But just across from that star, you might see a black bit of sky. So clearly, the sky is looking very different depending on where you look. This is not the case for the microwave background. Wherever we look, it's just a smooth sort of sheet, a smooth bath of radiation that's all very similar. And it turns out this radiation is a relic of when the universe was much, much smaller, much, much denser, and much, much hotter. And so by looking at this microwave background, we can look at the properties of this very, very early, very young, hot, dense universe. And it's actually quite surprising that this universe should look the same. We need a concept here called thermal equilibrium, and I'm sure you've all experienced this if you've made a nice hot cup of coffee at some point. Put it down on the bench, suddenly the phone rings, you go and answer the phone. By the time you get back, the coffee cup is cool. It is now the temperature of the outside room. So the coffee cup can interact with the air in the outside room and come to thermal equilibrium. They both come to the same temperature. But the coffee cup has had to be in contact with the room in order for this to happen. But what we find in the universe is that parts of the universe that have never been in contact with each other seem to be at the same temperature, exactly the same. They seem to be in thermal equilibrium. And this seems very odd. And the solution to this is that very, very early on in the universe, and I'm talking the first trillionth of a second, the universe, different parts of it, were in thermal equilibrium. They were quite close together. But then, for some reason that we don't really understand, the universe went through a massive growth spurt and was actually expanding at faster than the speed of light. So parts that were in contact were then flung apart, and ever since then, the light from them has not had enough time to reach the other part. However, even though they haven't been in contact, they seem to be the same. Now, even though the microwave background looks very similar, there are very, very slight differences. And as I say, they're smaller than one part in a thousand, but those differences are actually very, very important. And it's those very small differences that the WMAP probe is looking at. Because our models of inflation or other possible scenarios for the Big Bang predict different types of patterns in these little fluctuations. Now, what WMAP has found very, very strongly is that these little fluctuations look exactly what our theories tell us they should look like if the universe went through this inflationary stage. So the reason that the universe looks slightly different at different times is because, just like today, in the early universe, there were very small quantum fluctuations. So if we look in a vacuum today, we see little particles popping in and out of existence, little fluctuations happening all the time, but those little fluctuations in subatomic particles in the very, very early universe, when inflation happened, they were blown up and made much bigger. And those fluctuations is actually what has allowed things like galaxies to grow. A little bit of the universe, a little bit denser than somewhere else. Gravity made that greater density were bigger over time. So heavier things attract more stuff, they get bigger, they become galaxies, and that's how the universe has come to be. And this sort of pattern that we see in the microwave background is also the same sort of pattern that we see in galaxies today. So this is very, very promising for our ideas about the Big Bang universe. Now, the WMAP probe still has several more years to run, and in a couple of years, NASA will probably release more information and more data that will tell us more about the fascinating history and also the future of our universe.
And that was Matthew Francis reporting. Now, here at Diffusion, we get a fair bit of fan mail here from all of our science fans out there. But these guys, this is Emerald Rose, and they've actually sent us a tune, which we're going to grace them with and play on air today for you. So I hope you like it as much as we do. This is We Are Monkeys by Emerald Rose.
Darwin had a revelation. He said all life evolved from the confusion. He had a theory, it made some people nervous when he came to the embarrassing conclusion. We come from monkeys, we're not so special. We've only got a little extra DNA. The chimpanzees are very close to us. Australopithecus, he's not so far away. We come from monkeys swinging in the trees. A little bit of monkey inside you and me. Monkey in the middle, a monkey on your back. It's a fundamental problem, but a scientific fact. We come from monkeys. Feeble-minded said creation was the answer. They got upset, then those got out of joint. They say we're missing the monkey in the middle. They're picking it, it kinda proves a point. You're not so hairy, you haven't got a tail. You're not adapted for living in a tree. But if you care, count up all your chromosomes. You're 98.4% a chimpanzee. We come from monkeys swinging in the trees. A little bit of monkey inside you and me. A monkey in the middle, a monkey on your back. It's a fundamental problem, but a scientific fact. We come from monkeys. Monkey bars feel the primal beat. 6 million years we've been walking on our feet. A barrel full of monkeys swinging from the family tree. We don't want to start a social revolution. We just want to talk about some monkey evolution. But the knuckle dragging stool flinging fools just don't want to see. We come from monkeys. We'll be right back. evolving, then maybe you should just evolve a bigger mind. We come from monkeys swinging in the trees, a little bit of monkey inside you and me. A monkey in the middle, a monkey on your back. It's a fundamental problem, but a scientific fact. We come from monkeys. Monkey see, monkey do, monkey see, monkey do, monkey see, monkey do, monkey me, monkey you. Let's all face it, it's all true, we come from monkeys.
Once again, thanks to Emerald Rose. For any other fan mail you'd like to send it to us, maybe you've got a cool little anecdote, or maybe you've got some more music that you just want to plug for, you can send it to diffusion@2ser.com. Over the past decade, more Australians have been diagnosed with hepatitis C than any other notifiable disease. The word hepatitis means inflammation or swelling of the liver, and it can be caused by several kinds of viruses, alcohol, and some drugs. The main hepatitis viruses in Australia are A, B, and C, but they all cause different illnesses and require different treatment. On April 1st, access to subsidised treatment of Hep C will become slightly easier. It is estimated that there are currently more than 250,000 Australians living with Hep C and up to 16,000 new infections occurring each year. Our own Tilly Berlin spoke to Stuart Loveday, the Vice President of the Australian Hepatitis Council.
Well, hepatitis C is one of the most common hepatitis viruses in Australia. It's transmitted when the blood of a person who's got hepatitis C gets into the bloodstream of another person. It actually needs that blood-to-blood transmission. And that most commonly happens in about 90% of cases when people share equipment used to inject illicit drugs. So, and it's also transmitted through unsterile tattooing and unsterile body piercing. And there are a few other routes, but those are not that common these days.
Right. So what about the transmission rate in sexual activity?
Well, the good news is that hepatitis C is not classified as a sexually transmittable infection. So it's not an STI. If it is going to be transmitted in a sexual context, it's as a result of blood-to-blood contact during sex. And it's certainly not easy to transmit sexually.
And how does having hepatitis C affect people?
Well, it affects people in different ways. Usually very soon after infection, the majority of people, 80% or so, have no idea they've got infected. There are no outward signs or symptoms. It takes a very long time normally for symptoms to appear. And those symptoms, they can be quite mild on the one hand for some people. They can be very, very debilitating on the other. So, for instance, fatigue. Feelings of nausea, aches and body pains, especially in the liver region, sleep disturbances, sort of feeling of fuzziness around the brain. These are all classic symptoms of Hep C, but they can also be, those symptoms can be caused by other conditions as well.
So what about treatment? Can it be cured?
Well, again, there's some good news here. And yes, there is a highly effective treatment available. It's a combination therapy. Can bring about cure, so actual eradication of the virus, in between 50 and 80% of cases, depending on what type of hepatitis C virus you've got.
And I've also seen recently in the media that Australians with hepatitis C no longer need a liver biopsy to access the subsidised treatment. How do you think that will affect treating Australian population with hepatitis C?
Well, Tilly, that is an exceptionally welcome change, because that has been one of the barriers for people accessing treatment. So the impact of that is to increase treatment numbers, which we certainly need to do in Australia. But biopsy, let's not forget, is still a very important measure of liver damage. It's still the most reliable indicator of liver damage. So even though it's not an administrative requirement to access government-funded therapy anymore, with effect the 1st of April, it might still be a clinical requirement, and especially for those people who might be wavering, and they might think, do I need treatment or do I not need treatment? And quite often, a biopsy might help them to make the decision that they don't actually need treatment, because treatment can be, for many people, quite an arduous journey.
So where are the centres for research into hepatitis infection currently?
Well, there are a number of centres, and again, they are linked to the National Centres for HIV Research that were set up in the 1980s, in the late 80s, and they have taken on, and without any significant increase in funding, we must add, they've been requested to take on hepatitis C as well. And that is a big challenge, but the National Centre in HIV Social Research, the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research, the National Centre in Hepatitis and HIV Virology, all of these centres do incredibly good work in researching how to reduce the impact of the epidemic, either to prevent it from happening or prevent it from increasing, or help to improve the quality of life and help improve treatment.
And so what do you see happening in the near future about numbers of Australians with hepatitis C?
Well, unfortunately, treatment itself won't bring about a significant reduction in the numbers of people with hepatitis C. But I think the biggest challenge we are facing in hepatitis C is how to bring down the ongoing numbers. They range between 10 and 15,000 estimated new infections happening in Australia each year. How to bring those numbers down? And that is a very, very difficult challenge. But we know now that by the year 2020, whatever happens in with new infections, even if we reduce them to zero, which is pie in the sky, by the way, but even if we do reduce them to zero, we are still, with the current numbers, going to see a tripling in the numbers of liver cirrhosis, of end-stage liver failure, of liver cancer, and unfortunately of Hep C-related liver mortality.
What are the systems that are currently in place to increase prevention?
Fortunately, Australia was a world leader back in the mid-80s when they introduced, part of their drug policy, a process of harm minimization. Sometimes that's also called harm reduction. And the primary exponent of that is Australia's needle and syringe program. It was introduced mainly to stop HIV infections, and it's been exceptionally successful at that. It's been slightly less successful in preventing hepatitis C infections, simply because there was already a very large pre-existing pool of hepatitis C infections. And the other reason is that hepatitis C is around about 10 times more infectious than HIV. So needle and syringe programs are still our frontline defense against Hep C infections. The other angle is education and peer education, where people who inject drugs are informed and educated by their peers. That is a very, very powerful education tool, and one which I think Australia needs to invest in more, in addition to expanding the needle and syringe program. But those are the real two cornerstones of the fight to prevent hepatitis C infection. Unless we invest in prevention and treatment efforts now, in a far greater way than we ever have done, we are going to see a burgeoning out of healthcare costs to the extent where Australia will not be able to afford them.
So a focus on education of the community, increased needle exchange programs in our marginalised communities, and a greater awareness of what's going on out there.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, Tilly, by saying that there's a greater need for public awareness, impact on a greater need for political awareness.
And that was Stuart Loveday speaking to Tilly Boleyn. If you would like any further information about the prevention of and research into Hep C, you can contact your state or territory hepatitis council or go to www.hepatitisaustralia.com.
Brother, as a duty servant, be observant. The fact that seed pods produce fruit, eventually you must loot, can be the booty. Wickedly, some seeds be planted, attitudes slanted. And candidly, you can see me, so discern, but don't judge too harshly. Rule is not for us, seeds be sprouting paper licks, making it take the kicks. And even if the right flow collides, so sowing seeds, so some seed could breathe, so he sows until he sees some seed that breathe. Obviously, seeds are in the one place, you got trouble for asking. All the eggs been in the one basket, those will select the plot, and they will scatter the lot in order to bubble the crop. odds on top, getting points now, so he chooses the place until the spark is found to reap with pace. Imagine slinging seas down beside a road. Imagine birds eating them up quick and boots crushing husk. Or if you spill the pellets on a soil that's rocky.
Sadly, all good things must come to an end, and so must this week's episode of Diffusion. This week, Diffusion was brought to you by Matt Francis, Chris Stewart, Tilly Berlin, and Matthew Clark. Producing this morning was the great Matthew Clark, with Tilly Berlin playing Lord of the Panel Board. We record over here in the studios of 2SER Sydney and are brought to you across Australia by the Community Broadcasting Network. Our international fans, though, can catch us by searching for us at iTunes. Thanks for joining us for another week. I'm Jackie Pepper, and we'll see you next week on Diffusion.
Like a soul bullet, force have planned it like an industry to get to me. As we let the scroll unroll, we get some help, but the text is no less vexed by the self. Think of the self as like a shell, a coating, a sponge, able to absorb more knowledge, some wisdom. This is like a college and then some, a university of the soul. Don't get every weighted down by the worries of the world. Back out your slip, back in the old pigeonhole. Loosen the ties from the material self jams, and with slams know that you aspire to be greater. Remember the rose seed, the knowledge of life, it got plucked and crushed, the intellect went kaput. The rocky joint is a wasteland, and the dome growth this halter in the making. Knowledge is progressive, the building blocks must rock, the true foundations to withstand the forces. Don't want to bring it down to the human levels, force plucked and limited to brutal devils. You'd rather revel in the warm glow of self-indulgence, but when Pavlov calls, boy, you better jump. Are you a product of consciousness or morals? Is that earth there fertile or fallow? When your time is up, will you be called fickle, or is your existence just shallow? Seed is the word is brain food.